Mr. Gibson, Reel 3. You went to camp, you said, immediately prior to the war, and presumably this would give an opportunity to actually fire guns.
Well, being a signaller, I didn't have anything to do with them.
But you were in a situation where you were, I suppose, pretending to be in an action situation, doing your training How long were you at the drill hall with the battery that you've described before the changeover, before you changed?
Well, about 9 months, I would say.
And you were there all the time?
Yes, but during that time, we more or less did infantry work. We all had rifles, and we all manned positions. Early morning, you'd dash down, have a cup of coffee, and then go on standby. And then you watch the dawn come in until about 8 o'clock, and then it would be stand down, and then you went back to your billet and got yourself ready for the day's work.
So you were operating, as you say, as infantry?
Yes.
And were you watching the coast? Or
watching the coast, yes.
Was there any enemy air interference that you experienced?
Oh, yes, yes. They often came over. They bombed on the seafront here, and they bombed Sunderland while we were here. And, of course, later on, they sent us to Liverpool, and we did fire watching in Liverpool for months.
What time dates would these be?
This would be 1941, the summer of 1941.
So you're getting on for about 2 years of the war being on.
That's right, yes.
And the first 9 months, you say, you spent in this area.
Yes.
And
then we went down to Norfolk.
Did you have any ATS attached to the units?
No.
The ladies hadn't appeared then.
No.
So some of the lighter anti-aircraft did have ATS attached to them. So then you went down to Norfolk, you said?
That's right, yes.
What were you doing down there?
Well, that's where we got our anti-tank guns.
And what time of the year, what date is this now? 9 months after the war, is it?
That's right, yes. It's just the start of summer.
Had Dunkirk occurred before
yes,
that?
Yes, Dunkirk had been finished and over with, yes.
What was the mood of the people around you when that disaster occurred?
Well, it was very depressing. We were all despondent. And
did you fear that we were going to lose it?
Yeah, but there's something about the English spirit. We feel as though we can't lose, except at cricket, of course. But we think that we can't lose a battle because of our history, I suppose. We knew we'd had a terrific setback, but we all knew we would regroup and we would be okay.
Did that increase your, at this point in time, infantry role in fear of invasion, which might follow?
Oh, yes.
Immediately
yes, follow? Yes. We went onto the coast of Norfolk, to places like Seapolin and Munsley, where we had guns among the sand dunes. And every morning we were ready watching for fear of invasion.
Quite a bit of activity was there around the Norfolk area?
Yes, because there were many aerodromes nearby, and there was constant traffic of planes morning and night. And while we were there, of course, the Germans would often come over. In fact, our troop found five or six Germans coming ashore in a dinghy, and we took charge of them.
Where'd they come from?
Oh, the bailed out of a plane, yeah. Yes.
And were you actually there when you took them?
I was beside them. Yes, I wasn't. I didn't actually grab hold of them. Like,
did you find it curious to be looking at your enemy face to face?
Yes, but you felt sorry for them. They'd spent all night out in the at sea, and one of them spoke beautiful English. So.
And presumably they weren't in the best of condition.
No.
Pleased to be taken.
Yes.
And of course, all this activity is going on, and you're in an anti-tank gun situation.
Yes,
so you couldn't really get involved in firing back at them.
Yes.
When you changed to a 125 anti-tank, as you said, and you lost your signalling role then.
Yes.
So what did you train as then?
I became number three on the gun. Now, number three on the anti-tank gun, you sat on a seat. With your right hand, you elevated or depressed the gun. With your left hand, you traversed the gun, right or left. With your right foot, you could press down and release the cog mechanism so the gun, you could swing around. With your left foot, you fired the gun, but at the same time, you looked through a telescope at your target. And when we went to Tros Fini in North Wales, our troop, we were so good with our anti-tank guns that we destroyed all the targets and they had to build new ones. They were very accurate.
It's a lot to remember. You've got both your hands and both your feet working at different times.
But it was interesting. And you had to judge how far to be in front of the target as it was moving, because there was what you call brain lag and mechanical lag, you see. You had to allow for those two things.
What gun was it?
It was a 2-pounder anti-tank.
Which were almost out of date when you got them.
Yes.
How many crew would that gun have?
About six.
Can you name the various responsibilities of each
one?
Well,
the sergeant stood behind you and he looked to see where there was a target. And then he would say, target left or target right. And quick, and you pressed that down and he could swing your gun around, you see. Number two would be putting the shells. Number three was my job, firing. Number four would be passing the shells to, and so forth it went.
And in the early days, there must have been some fumbling and stumbling as you tried to remember which hand
well,
did what.
That's right. But the thing was, these anti-tank guns were on wheels. You had to take the wheels off and put them down onto the ground where the big spikes would go into the ground. So you carried your guns on the back of a truck called a portee. It came down a ramp, then you had to wheel it into position and then get the weak spike and lift it up, take the wheels off and drop it into position.
Could you fire it from the portee?
Yes, but there was such a kickback, you couldn't really. It would be possible, but there would be a kickback. You could fire it on the wheels, but the thing would bounce about 10 feet into the air.
Could you describe the gun itself to me?
It was small barrel. It had a shield on the front. And the barrel itself went through the middle of the shield. And on the left was the telescope. Once you took the wheels off, of course, there were two arms just like elbow joints, and you dropped those, and they had spikes on which went into the ground.
Efficient little weapon, was it?
We were led to believe so, but many people say that the shells actually bounced off good tanks.
It's just a small shell, really.
Yes, 2-pounders, very small.
Armour piercing, was it? Or?
Yes.
A good crew, what would be the speed of fire, rapid fire, of a good crew, a well-trained crew? How many shells per minute or whatever?
Oh, I have no idea. We never got down to trying that out.
I mean, pretty quick, presumably.
Yes, oh yes.
A well-trained crew.
Yes.
And essentially, you were just training with it and not getting much chance, obviously no chance really, to do anything serious with it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, we weren't getting anything serious with it to such a degree that I was hearing about our poor pilots who were having such a terrible job against the Luftwaffe, and so many of them were being killed. I saw a notice, the Air Ministry, you know, your country needs you, young men, the Air Force needs young pilots. So without asking my troop officer, who would ask my battery major, who would ask the colonel, I wrote to the Air Ministry and said I would like to be a pilot. And unknown to me, about other five in the regiment like me did so. And we got travel passes to go down to Cardington. And I went down to Cardington and had 2 or 3 days in which I was questioned and examined, and terrific medical examination. And I was given a piece of paper to say that I passed to be trained as a pilot in a two-seater night fighter. I went back to the colonel and showed him the piece of paper, and he wouldn't let me out. With the result that later my mother had a letter from the War Ministry saying that I was believed to be a prisoner. At the same time, she got one from the Air Ministry saying that I'd failed to turn up and I was presumed to be a deserter.
And this brought on basically because it was I was so boring.
I was getting bored. I wanted action.
When you were in Norfolk, where were you stationed?
Part of the time in Norwich City itself. It was a park outside the city called Catton Park. We spent time in bell tents there. Then we were moved into the Bishop's Palace, right in the grounds of the cathedral. We spent a few months there. But while we were there, we used to make journeys to the coast, manning different gun positions.
And the accommodation, obviously the tents would not be so pleasant, but the Bishop's Palace must have been...
Don't let that... In my 6 years, nearly 7 years in the forces, the only time I slept in a bed was when I went down to Cardington to the Air Force. Previous to that, we slept on grass, on wood floors, and in Bishop's Palace on concrete. We never slept in beds.
Were these on palliasses?
We could put straw in our palliasses, yes. Most of us found it was too much getting straw and filling it and then unfilling it again. We just didn't bother.
And the drills that you would do, were you still subjected to drilling?
Yes, we did marching drill and rifle drill. In fact, we did probably more rifle drill than the infantry, because we had one sergeant major with us who was from the Highland Light Infantry originally. And he used to love his bayonet practice. So we did bayonet practice with him.
Did you take training in gas precautions in the early stages?
Yes. When up in Scotland, there was a little valley there. And they filled the valley with gas and we walked through it, yes. And then another time they had a tent and filled with gas and we walked through that.
And was it when you're up in Scotland after being in Norwich? Was this part
yes,
of
the from day? Norwich. Very, very severe winter. We went up into Scotland to a place called Duns.
And what you were doing up there?
Just practicing with our anti-tank guns. By then, we had porties. We were fully equipped. We had the porties and the guns. And we were doing a huge training exercise.
Were you sleeping in tents?
Sleeping in a castle on the concrete floor, wind howling, there no windows.
And you said it was a bad winter. Which winter was this?
1941. when we, I was on the advance party going from Norwich, right? We got up to Duns and we were in Nissen Huts. Everything was frozen. To get a shave, you had to go and get a bucket of snow and put it over one of those potbelly stoves. And do you know, a bucket of snow only gives you about a quarter of a pint of water. That's how we used to shave.
And the eating situation, was it? Did you always have the typical army food throughout your English experience?
Oh, yes, yes. Typical army food, yes.
And can you tell me what would you get for breakfast?
Oh, you got bacon and eggs, yes. Yes. Nearly always bacon and eggs.
Plenty of it, sir.
Oh, yes, yes. For a person like me, yes. I don't know how these big chaps managed to. We had one man in our regiment. He was called Any Mare Bacon because every breakfast time when he'd finished, he would shout at the top of his voice, Any Mare Bacon. And anyone who had not been able to eat their bacon gave it to him.
Dinner, what were you likely to get? The main meal?
Oh, variety, yes. Good variety.
Meat, vegetables?
Meat and vegetables, yes.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Scotland?
Just about 4 or 5 months. Because from Duns we moved to Selkirk, and from Selkirk we went to Gourock and we embarked on a ship called the Strathaird.
Now, Japan was now in the war, was
no,
it?
No.
December 41 that Japan
no.
came in?
Japan wasn't in the war.
Oh, so this is before, prior to this?
Yes, yes.
So the harsh winter that you were in Scotland,
the start of 41.
Ah, right, you're 40, 41,
end of 40,
yes,
to
yes.
41.
And you moved around Scotland then, as you were saying, yeah. And then down to... What date did you sail?
It was probably the September, October.
So prior to Japan?
Oh, yes, prior, before. Yes.
And did you know where you were going?
No. We had been issued with... tropical gear, which was typical North African, with the topis, the shorts. Yes. So we presumed we were going to the Middle East. But, having been on the ship for about a fortnight, we were out in the Atlantic and we bumped into a, in the fog and the dark, we bumped into a ship called the Stirling Castle. And both ships were damaged, and both ships had to come back into the Clyde. So I was given a week's survivor's leave.
Had you the usual leave given when you were going abroad?
Prior to going abroad? No, we'd had leave, our normal leave, you see. Nobody said, this is your last leave before you're going abroad.
Embarkation leave. Yes. So you'd have your normal leave. How much leave would you get, say, in a year?
I don't know. I just took it when it came.
And you'd go home, of course, to your family.
Yes, of course, yes.
And your mother would see you in your uniform.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the... What did you find for people in your hometown when you came home for a leave? Did they kind of made a fuss over? There were so many people.
It used to annoy me. The first you say, "Oh, you're on leave. When do you go back?"
So you did one little sail, had an accident, and then came back, and you had to wait how long at?
Well,
you got
we did a spot of fire watching in Glasgow. We were stationed in the girls' high school, and then we moved down to Manchester, Stockport, and from there we did spots of fire watching at Liverpool.
They gave you all kinds of jobs to do, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
as a military unit.
Yeah. Fire watching, we used to Highton. Harold Wilson used to be a member of Parliament for Highton, and there was a council house estate that had just been built and nobody had lived in, and we went into that. And we slept in there during the day. We were supposed to sleep during the day. And then buses would take us down to Liverpool, ready for the night time. And we would be on the in the go-downs, the warehouses, on the docks at Liverpool, until the next morning, and buses would bus us back again. But Liverpool was still smouldering. You know, every street end there were still piles, and firemen would come now and again and try to douse it.
Was there any rage when you were actually doing
it? Oh, yes, yes.
So that must have been frightening.
Oh, yes, yes. Was not knowing where, when you heard the whistling.
And you would see the, you know, the worst of the bombing and,
yes,
and the, its results on it.
Yes. I remember going into Liverpool City and going into seeing a beautiful store like Lewis's and going with beautiful cinema and seeing John Wayne. And then the next time you went in, they weren't there, you see.
Did you get involved with searching for survivors in the bombing raids?
Yes,
you
know, yes, yes.
When they were over?
Yes.
What are your memories of that?
Oh, it was... luckily, I didn't have... But we were off Great Howard Street, and there'd been so much bombing round there. The gable ends of some houses were gone, and the rest was there. And we used to wave to one chap in bed, you know, no end to his house, and he was in bed with all his furniture round him. People, they just were used to it, they accepted it.
You found that they were, you know, quite steadfast, very steady.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
How long did you do that?
Did two spells of that.
This would be while the ship was being repaired, was it?
I think so, yes.
So when you sailed the second time, what date was that?
The second time we sailed, we went from Avonmouth, near Bristol, and we went on a different ship. We went on the Oronce.
Now, what are your memories of the voyage? For example, let's start with the sleeping quarters, the berthing quarters. Where were you sleeping on the ship?
Down below. I didn't like being down below, and we were in hammocks. And I remember the hammocks. When you looked at the ship, they would all go like that, and all go like that. But it wasn't the hammocks that were moving. They were staying still, and it was the ship that was doing that. I used to be fascinated by that.
How do you find hammocks to sleep in?
I liked them.
They're quite difficult to get into, aren't
they? Yes, yes. Oh, yes, you've got to pull yourself in.
And can you move around in a hammock, you know, turn around from one side?
Oh, you can swivel around, yes. You get used to them.
And were these on the same quarters that you ate on?
Yes, yes. You dismantled your hammock and rolled it up, and your tables were underneath. In fact, you climbed on your bench that you sat on and onto the table to get into your hammock. But the hammocks were rolled up and put away every morning. And then you had your tables at which you ate.
Well, what time would be reveille on the ship?
About 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock.
And your first would be to get your hammock rolled up and then,
yes,
obviously wash and your dress and so on.
Yes, and then go for breakfast. If I were in charge, I would go get the breakfast things and bring them down.
On your table, you're, yes, allotted,
yes,
a table.
Yes.
Did you have a rank, Banner? Had you been promoted?
Yeah. I was made a Lance Bombardier very early, just after the war started, and then I was promoted full Bombardier when we were in Norwich.
And you, in effect, then you would be actually in charge of a table, were you?
Yes, yes.
What was the feeding method? You said you had to go and seek it, or?
Well, we went to the galley, and we came back with tins, containers. I think there were 14 to a table, and you put it out there, and then served it out.
Did that cause a problem, serving out? Yes, it would be pretty accurate on who was getting...
No, I mean, there's always 14 sausages or 14 eggs.
After breakfast, what might your duties be then?
Go up on deck, have a roll call, probably do some PE.
Did you do boat drills?
Boat drills, yes.
And you'd be allotted a certain...
Yes, you had your boat station, yes.
When that was over, when you'd done your PE, about the rest of the day?
Probably in groups, having talks. We had one officer who could speak a little bit Arabic. And, you know, certain that we were going to the Middle East, he started to teach us Sahida Sahab, Sahida Salaam Alaikum, and so that sort of thing.
Did you have a lot of time to yourselves on the boat?
Yes, yes.
How did you get over that? Because it's a long journey and a pretty boring one.
Conversation. And we had some people from different parts of the country, and they would tell us what it was like in their part of the country. And because most of us were from Sunderland area, you see.
Canteen on the boat?
On the British boat, I don't know. But I'll be telling you later about the American boat.
Did you have any form of sporting activities on the boat?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. There was boxing, you know, boxing matches. Some people thought they could do all in wrestling, and they tried a bit of that.
Any theatrical works going on? I mean, you were a musician.
Yes, we had little concerts. I always carried my banjo with me wherever I went, and it was quite a heavy, big thing. And I mean, I've got photographs of me playing it. And that was Huyton Camp, when we were resting between fire watching.
Are they George Formby songs, are they, that they played and sang?
No, I didn't go for George Formby. He was a ukulele man, you see. I played a proper banjo.
Was discipline particularly strong on the boat? Or more relaxed?
I think it was more relaxed. It wasn't so easy to get to people on the boat. The officers had to come down, you know. Shout us out.